Okay, a couple of just brief things before we begin the lecture. There was a problem with the video link for the video recordings of the class, which had to do with some permissions setting that I hadn't realized I needed to do. That should all be working now. I know a couple of students had wanted to look at some of the lectures that they missed. So that should all be functioning just fine now. If you have any trouble, just send me an email and I'll see if I can troubleshoot it for you. Secondly, tomorrow night there is a showing of a film at the Marquee Theater in Union South called Sugar Coated, which is very relevant to the material for this week, for the issue of the market and healthcare, and the issue of the role of industry in creating health problems and then obstructing their solution. The sugar-coated story about sugar is quite similar to the story about tobacco. And I think it's an excellent documentary. This is a documentary film that's part of a series that's done at the Marquee Theater called Social Cinema. And all of the films this semester, I think, are excellent. I'll tell you about other ones that are relevant to the material in the course as they come up. I do have the trailer for this film, which I think would be worth us seeing if I can get it up here. Let's see if we get it to work this time. We tested out. I think I've got audio now. So it just worked when we tried.
Some people in the environment is causing diabetes and heart disease and obesity. We don't know what it is. Maybe it's just that people eat too much. Maybe it's that we're not physically active.
I'm going to start it at the beginning since there was a little bit of.
If you think about this as a court case, something in the environment is causing diabetes and heart disease and obesity. We know what it is. Maybe it's just that people eat too much. Maybe it's that we're not physically active enough. Maybe it's the dietary fat. Maybe it's the sugar.
For more than 4 years, probably longer, this industry, it appears, has been deceived.
We have never, throughout human history, been exposed to the levels of sugar intake.
How is it that we're still debating whether there's a relationship between sugar consumption and diabetes? And this reminds me a lot of tobacco
executives.
Where we are in the sugar debate is not where the tobacco debate was in about 1960. They're all using the same playbook, that they're manipulating science, that they're coming in pretending to be everybody's best friend, but they have a very strong political agenda to protect their corporate interests.
This is certainly the first obesity conference where Sugar's Weak Marriage Committee and the Fast Food Committee have sponsored this event.
A lot of people this morning have said to me, why are you here? And gee, it's awfully courageous of you to be here.
Is it possible that sugar is toxic? How we manifest love and happiness by the night you go after sugar, which is funny that we give our 1-year-olds on their first birthday. It's not that simple to know what the right thing is.
So I would encourage you, if you have time, to go to the Marquee Theater. It's free. It's a nice feature of the Marquee Theater. It has first-run movies and various projects, such as this one, that are free to the public. That will be on Wednesday at 7 p.m. Okay, healthcare. When I designed the course, many years ago, healthcare was one of the topics that Joel Rogers and I decided we really wanted to talk about because it has such interesting problems when you try to think about how to connect the market to the provision of healthcare. Then along comes the big controversy 7 or 8 years ago around the introduction of the Obama healthcare proposals, which then became law. And we had to redo everything. We had to redo the chapter in the textbook because the Obama health reforms changed the connection between the market and the healthcare system, although not as profoundly as many of the critics of the Obama health reforms suggested. It was still very much in the United States a market-driven and market-anchored system of healthcare provision. But we revised the chapter and we thought, okay, at least now we have a stable system with a set of rules that we can then talk about and then focus. In fact, in the lecture that I gave, in the previous time I gave this course, the lecture spent quite a bit of time talking about the problems in the Obama healthcare reforms that comes precisely from too much role for the market. Now what are we in the year 2017? We face an era where once again the healthcare system is going to be revamped, but not in order to strengthen the collective provision of healthcare services for the American population to make it a more effectively and efficiently universal system, but to try to restore even more importance, more centrality, more weight of the market in organizing our system, which is already the most market-driven healthcare system in the world. Alas, I think that means, depends upon what happens, that once again I'll have to revise the chapter in the book. I didn't especially want to have a third edition of the book. It's a lot of work to revise these things. But it looks like the current equilibrium is not in fact stable. Well, what I'd like to do in this lecture is to help you make sense of what's going on here. How to think about the problem of healthcare. It's a big part of our economy. It's something, the order of magnitude is approaching 20% of our total economy is centered around, in different ways, the provision of healthcare services. And if you expand the definition a little bit to include various aspects of the exercise industry and the health foods industry, you know, there's a variety of things that aren't directly the delivery of healthcare services, then it's probably the case that well over 20%, perhaps even as high as 25% of our economy, is in one way or another connected to our concerns with health, either for treatment, for prevention, or for general healthy living endeavors. It's a big part of the economy. It's not a small part. And therefore, how we think about it, and particularly how we think about how it works, American society, how it really works, is really important. These are all issues that you will be confronting. Whatever happens in the current reforms, it will not be stable. We're not at the end of this story. Even if Obamacare is repealed and it's replaced with some other jerry-rigged, half-baked system, it won't be stable. Because none of these market-centered solutions to the provision of health care work. They can't work. There's too many intrinsic flaws. It would be like saying, should we have a market provision of national defense? Well, nobody thinks that, of course. Well, I suppose there's some people who might think having private armies and mercenary forces as the central mechanisms of defense, where we just have a market for defense, might be a good one. Most people, nearly everybody thinks we need the direct government provision of national defense. Well, markets don't work very well for healthcare provision, and the important thing is to understand why, and to figure out what is the appropriate role. When I say markets don't work, I mean that markets don't work as the central organizing principle for the delivery of healthcare. Not that there isn't a role for markets, but we have to figure out, in a subtle and complex way, how to connect the market to healthcare rather than to subsume healthcare under the market. All right, well, that's my end point. Let's now look at the problem. First, we need to get some basic ideas. What is so distinctive about healthcare as a commodity? Remember that I'm using the term commodity. It means something produced for the market. So what's distinctive about this? There's a number of things I would emphasize. First, the extraordinary value of the service. Most people really care about how healthy they are. They don't take sickness as just a, oh, this is interesting. I mean, I've tried very hard to treat my broken leg as an interesting experience. You know, you recode it from an awful experience to an interesting experience. It makes it a little easier to cope with. But people really care about being healthy. When given the choice of dying or having health care provision, at least if you're young, you know, young, middle-aged, and not at the end of your life, most people would rather have good quality health care. And when asked, well, is it worth it to you? They would say yes, if they can afford it. Healthcare is extraordinarily valuable to people. And that's one of the reasons why people are prepared to spend a great deal of their incomes on healthcare when they're forced to do so. Secondly, unlike most things produced for the market, there are very serious ethical issues in the distribution of healthcare. It's not a matter of indifference. Now, for the distribution of flat-screen televisions, we can say, well, if you can't afford it, too bad. You know, you can live without a big flat-screen television. It's not a necessity of life. For healthcare, most people are pretty reluctant to say, if you can't afford it, just go ahead and die. You know, most people just aren't heartless in that way. They do feel that there is an ethical, moral issue in the access to health care, and something has to be done. It's why hospitals and doctors provide lots of pro bono services. They provide it for free to people who can't afford it, which means not that nobody's paying for it, it's that they're paying for it with their own time and resources, or they are displacing the costs of that pro bono care onto other patients. Yet there are huge ethical issues. And these ethical issues mean that some forms of rationing are inevitable. Consider, for example, the problem of transplants. There are thousands of kidney transplants done in the United States every year. Nearly all are done from what are called cadaver donors, people who have indicated on their driver's license or in some other way that if they die and their kidneys are in good shape, that they will make them available for transplants. Something I recommend you all do on your driver's license. You know, if you get killed in a bicycle accident sometime, and you've got good kidneys, they could help somebody live. So it's an ethical thing to do. Well, we could have a market for those kidneys. We could just put them up for auction. That would be the market solution. You have a kidney bank, you know, and when you die, your kidneys would be made available, and then people bid on the kidneys. And the richer you are, the more likely you are to get a kidney. Well, doctors are insistent that that would be an immoral way of distributing kidneys. We can't let the market determine who gets access to a kidney transplant, given that they're in scarce supply, and you can't increase the supply easily. Until such time as we have artificial kidneys, which is not probably that long into the future, the supply of kidneys for transplants will be limited, and we need a rationing system. And the rationing system that's in place, it's complicated. It has a list of people who need kidneys, and they're in the queue depending upon how urgently they need it and how likely it is that the kidneys will work for them. So if you have lots of other health risks, lots of other health problems, so that a kidney, if transplanted, is unlikely to prolong your life very long because of other complications, then you would be lower down on the list. If you're young and healthy in all other respects but have kidney failure, you'd be higher on the list. But your wealth plays no role, and your status, how famous you are, whether you're a celebrity or an ordinary person without renown, that plays zero role in placing you on the list. And occasionally there are scandals where somebody, because of their influence, is able to buy their way through influence more than through bribes to the higher up on the list. And that's considered a violation of ethical principles, certainly within the medical community, and I think for most people as well. Now, there's no other product for which that's true. You know, the waiting list to get a particular model of cars, if they organize this waiting list by having you put a deposit down or by having you be willing to pay a premium on the car price, who cares? That's just the way the market works. Doesn't work for transplants. And that's just as an example of the general problem that rationing in one way or another is needed. Third point, there's tremendous information costs for the average consumer to know what to do. You know, if you're buying a new smartphone, you can go online and look at the various reviews of different smartphones, and with a modest amount of effort, you can get reasonable information as to which ones seem to have the features you want, which ones are more robust, which ones have had reported problems. Turns out even for smartphones, it's not all that easy to get really good information that you really rely on, but you can do something. Consumer Reports provides you with reviews of washing machines or dishwashers, and you can get, you know, a reasonable set of higher quality information. It's awfully tough for most people to get good information either about what doctor to choose or what clinic to be affiliated with, and certainly what treatment would be optimal for whatever illness they have. It's just too complicated, which means that the process by which consumers make their choices is grounded in their extent of trust on authoritative figures, of which doctors are the most important, in providing them with good information. Now, of course, it's also true that patients ought to try to be as informed as possible. And if you're well educated and have the right social networks, you probably are able to get reasonably well informed so you know what questions to ask your doctor, and you can engage in dialogue, and you can express some skepticism, and etc. But all of that is extremely demanding. And it's particularly demanding because the time when consumers need that information are also typically times of enormous stress and difficulty in their lives. Right? You know, you're in the hospital, you have a dire disease, and you're called upon to make choices between alternative courses of treatment. That's very tough, specifically with respect to this information problem. And remember when we talked about the general issues of the market, what makes a market work well? Well, perfect information. The consumer needs the right information to be able to make choices about the trade-offs between increased cost and the qualities and whatever in the healthcare system for many, many aspects of the choices that have to be made. That's simply not a realistic thing to do. My mother is 99, still doing okay, but I have what's called medical power of attorney. Not that she couldn't make choices, but it's just overwhelming for her. Well, what if she didn't have a professor son, you know, who could step in and make those choices? Her only option would be to let somebody else. The market just doesn't work when information is so difficult. And there's another problem, and this is the issue of preventative medicine. We have a market in treatment for illness and a much weaker market for health. What people want is to be healthy, but what the market provides is treatment for being unhealthy, which means that the preventative aspects of medicine, which really are fundamental, I mean, if we really want to improve the health of a population or your own health, what you really want to be tuned into is all the preventative things you can do to keep yourself from getting sick, not what are the best options once I get sick. Now, of course, inevitably people do get sick, so I'm not saying there shouldn't be either a market or a service to provide treatment. But there's this mismatch between the way the market makes its most of its money and what people really want. You see, the market for pharmaceuticals, they make their money when you get sick and they provide medications for disease. If there was a pill that you could take that would keep you from getting any illness, you know, a magic pill, that would be devastating to the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry would just collapse if there was a health pill, so to speak, that would just make you robustly healthy and you just wouldn't get all the diseases which pharmacy provides cures for. There isn't a health pill that's, as far as I know, this isn't one of the nefarious things that industry has done to suppress the health pill, which has really already been developed. No, it hasn't happened. But you can see why the logic of maximizing your profits, and that's what a profit-making firm is supposed to do, maximize profits. To maximize your profits, if you're a drug manufacturer, you want to maximize your profits in the production of cures for diseases, not in the prevention of diseases. This is a really interesting issue. Supply generates demand. Remember the story about consumer sovereignty? That's basically that people have preferences, and if you're a clever producer, you figure out what people want, and you produce something, and the demand then generates the supply. The demand for smartphones generates the supply of smartphones and new innovations in smartphones. Now, in medicine, there's this very peculiar feature. It's not exclusive to medicine, but it's probably the best example, where if you create the supply of a particular treatment, it generates a demand for it. A good example is if a hospital purchases a CAT scan, you know, a fancy diagnostic machine that's important for diagnosing certain diseases. What the hospital then tells doctors is, we've got a CAT scan and we would like to use this as what part of our treatment services, our diagnostic services, because we need to pay back the investment in this CAT scan. And so suddenly the demand for CAT scans goes up. Once the supply is there, the demand for the use of that treatment or that diagnosis in this case goes up. Here, we don't need that anymore. Supply generates demand. And this is bound up with a really strange feature of the healthcare system. Competition between providers leads to overinvestment, too much investment. If one hospital in a region gets an MRI machine or a CAT scan machine, then all the other hospitals have to get it as well. Even if the need for CAT scans in the population is such that one CAT scan machine for that market of healthcare would be sufficient. But every hospital has to get it because they're competing for patients, which means that they all invest in CAT scans, which means they all encourage their doctors to use CAT scans, and suddenly the use of this particularly expensive diagnostic tool goes up. Competition between providers leads to overinvestment. And that's one of the reasons why American medical expenses and the healthcare system is so expensive. We do have more competition than other countries. We do have a more market-driven system. And that pushes up costs rather than pushes down costs, because it leads to this cycle of overinvestment and then supply creating demand and so on. Well, these are all distinctive features of healthcare as a commodity. This is true everywhere. There are all of these tendencies. And then the question is, what's the nature of the system through which you provide healthcare given these properties? So now let's look at the U.S. system, at various aspects of it. First, it's an incredibly complicated system. All healthcare systems are complex because diseases are complex, and the circumstances of people are complex, and their connection to their communities are complex. It's very different to provide healthcare in a rural setting than in an urban setting, or in a setting where there are strong networks of family support versus a situation where people live in relatively isolated lives, so they can't count on strong healthcare support after surgery, for example, when they go home. So healthcare is always complicated. The US system, however, is complicated in really complicated ways. Here are the components of the system. These are all the different ways in which healthcare is paid for in the United States. Private fee-for-service payment. You can walk into a doctor's office and pay directly for a healthcare service. A lot of dentistry is done that way in the United States. Mostly people, when they go to the dentist, just go and pay the bill rather than having any kind of insurance cover it. Secondly, we have employer-provided insurance. This is a very big deal in the United States. Starting in the 1950s, this became the dominant way that most people get their health insurance. My health insurance is provided through the state of Wisconsin health insurance system that's specific, the version of that that's tied to university employment. A third way that people get their health care is government-provided insurance. Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor are the two primary government insurance programs. In both Medicare and Medicaid, the government itself doesn't provide the health care. It's not that we have Medicare hospitals that are run by the government or hospitals for the poor that are run by the government. No, the doctors and hospitals are all just doctors and hospitals in whatever system they are. It's just that the bills are paid for by Medicare or by Medicaid. Many people who receive Medicare quickly forget that it's a government program. There was a famous moment in the political protests around the initial introduction of Obamacare. Back in the debates around it were in 2011. It was implemented slowly but definitively in 2014. There was this protest in which senior citizens were holding up signs saying, keep the government off of my Medicare, as if it wasn't a government program. You know, they had this idea that somehow this was just an organic part of the healthcare system, that healthcare was provided free for the elderly. And they were worried that Obamacare was going to take their Medicare away from them. But of course, Obamacare was just an addition to the existing government-provided services. So government-provided insurance is another way. We have government-subsidized insurance. And that's fundamentally what the Obama program is, what the ACA. The ACA stands for the Affordable Care Act, ACA. The ACA was mostly a provision of a way of subsidizing insurance premiums so that people who didn't get it from their employers and who weren't old enough to get Medicare and couldn't afford to just go out on the market and buy it just straight from an insurance company could nevertheless afford, thus Affordable Care Act, health insurance, by getting it in a subsidized way. The government provided subsidies for health insurance. And that's mostly what the ACA consisted of. There were a number of other really crucial elements. The one that I think has gotten the most, the two that have gotten the most attention, which I will discuss in a moment, aside from just the straight subsidization of the insurance market, were first a new rule that applied to all insurance companies in healthcare, namely that they could not deny a person health insurance because of a pre-existing condition. And they couldn't drop you from health insurance because you got sick. Before the ACA, with many insurance policies, if you got sick, then when it was time to renew your health insurance, the company would refuse to renew it. We don't insure sick people, we only insure healthy people against illness, but we don't insure you if you're sick. Well, the pre-existing conditions was a big problem. If you were uninsured, or if you were insured with your employer and you lost your job, so you lost your insurance, and you tried to buy insurance and you had a pre-existing condition, even something like asthma, you know, not a life-threatening pre-existing condition, just a pre-existing condition, insurance companies could refuse to insure you or could exclude that condition from your insurance. Well, the ACA said no. Can't write insurance policies that exclude people for pre-existing conditions. And the second issue that's gotten a lot of attention is the mandate. The Obama reforms required people to buy insurance. You know, it was no longer a voluntary action. Everybody was required by law to, with some special exceptions, but everybody was required by law to buy insurance or pay a penalty. But we'll discuss that in a moment. Okay, that's the fourth type, government subsidized insurance. Fifth, the direct government provision of health care. If you're in the military and you get shot in combat, the military itself directly provides health care. And if you're a veteran, the Veterans Administration provides directly government-provided health care for veterans, which, as we'll see later in the lecture, until the Iraq and the Afghan wars, until those wars overwhelmed the capacity of the VA system was considered the premier, the best health care provider in the United States, the best hospital system for Americans, better than the Mayo Clinic and other famous hospitals in terms of the quality of care and the consistency of care. That's no longer true, but for reasons we'll discuss. But it's one of the ways that healthcare is provided in the United States. Not the government insuring you, just paying the bills, but the government actually directly organizing the provision of healthcare services. And finally, pro bono services and charity. That's a significant component of the American healthcare system. If all of these other mechanisms fail, if you have people who don't have insurance and can't afford it, well, it still gets provided in one way or another, in many cases, pro bono, meaning without charge, or through charity. Well, that's a pretty complicated system. Second point, the American healthcare system is the most expensive in the world. We spend more on healthcare than any other country, and rapidly increasing costs. Here's a chart through 2010. The American curve flattened off in the first couple of years of the healthcare reforms, but it remains much higher than any other any other country, developed or underdeveloped. We're the most expensive, but we have lower access to healthcare than any other country. We are the only rich country without a universal system. Even with the Affordable Care Act, even with the Obama system, it wasn't universal. There were still 27 million people in the United States who were uninsured under the reforms. We're the only country in the world without a universal health care system of one sort or another. Here's a chart not in the book of the uninsured rate among non-elderly population from 1995 to 2015. And you can see that when the Obama healthcare reforms were instituted in 2014, that's when it really kicked in. So there were some elements which kicked in before, but the crucial ones, the subsidization of insurance, started in 2014. We suddenly had a significant drop in the proportion of the population that had no insurance at all. Prior to the ACA reforms, about 48 million people were uninsured in the United States. In 2016, it dropped to about 27 million. That's where that figure of 20 million people being at risk to losing their insurance if the ACA was simply repealed and not replaced with some other system to make it possible for people to get insurance who couldn't afford it. This is about access again. This is what this shows: access to insurance for people below the poverty rate, between 100% and 400% of the poverty rate, and above 400% of the, by poverty rate I mean the federal poverty level, how much income you have to have in order to be considered poor. And what this shows is for 2013, 14, and 15, the percentage of people who are uninsured. And it divides it into two kinds of states. Part of the Affordable Care Act was to dramatically expand eligibility for Medicaid. Remember, Medicaid is the specific government program to provide health insurance for the poor. Medicaid, you get your insurance without paying anything. So it's really meant to provide directly health insurance for people who can't afford it. It's similar to Medicare, which provides health insurance to the elderly, but it's a means-tested program providing health insurance for the poor. In the ACA, there was a big expansion of Medicaid, funded by the federal government. The Supreme Court ruled that the federal government, that the law could not force states to participate in the expansion of Medicaid, because Medicaid, although it's a national program funded by the federal government, nevertheless is administered by the states. And the Supreme Court ruled that the states had the right to say, no, we don't want this extra money. Even though the money, the extra money for this expanded Medicaid, 90% of it came from federal government money, and only 10% from the state, states could say, no, we don't want the money. Wisconsin is one of the states that refused to get the expansion of Medicaid to increase accessibility of the poor to free health insurance. So what this chart shows is the rate of uninsured population by poverty status among those states that did accept the expansion of Medicaid and those states which didn't. And as one would expect, the decline of the uninsured population was significantly greater in states that did accept this additional Medicaid money. The primary reason for being uninsured among the uninsured, and this is about access to health insurance, 46% said they tried to get coverage, but it was too expensive. So even though there's subsidy, the subsidy can still mean you have to pay quite a lot of money, particularly if you're not in a Medicaid state. If you're not in a Medicaid expansion state, then you can be pretty poor, and the only way you can get insurance is by getting the subsidized insurance, but the premiums can still be pretty high. These charts are going to be in the PowerPoints, which are online, so you can study them deeply outside of class. This is an interesting chart. This says, looking forward to 2024, what are the estimates of insurance rates? What percentage of people will be uninsured and what percentage of people will get their insurance in different ways? So the figure on the left, insurance exchanges, that's the subsidized part of the Affordable Care Act. If the Affordable Care Act continues to 2024, then about a little bit below 10% of the population would get their insurance through the subsidized market. That's the only part of this whole thing that is directly the result of the innovation of the Obamacare. That is, it's providing subsidies to the private insurance market. If there is no Affordable Care Act, if it's eliminated, of course, nobody gets their insurance in that way. That's reflected in the right-hand bars, where the uninsured goes up to about 20% of the population in the absence of the Affordable Care Act. But note that the crucial ways in which people, in the absence of the Obamacare programs, get their insurance, the most important, employer insurance, changes hardly at all. One of the criticisms of the Obamacare health reforms is that it would encourage employers to stop giving health insurance. The estimates are that if we continue to have the Affordable Care Act, there'll be a very small decline in health insurance provided by employers. It's still going to be basically an employer-based system, supplemented by individual non-group insurance, unsubsidized, and Medicaid for the poor. But the impact on the overall process by which insurance is acquired is modest. About 10% of the population gets it through exchanges with Obamacare. Nobody gets subsidized insurance in the absence. Okay, let me now discuss this problem of how this works, how the Obama system works, because I think there's a lot of confusion about this. And particularly the things which have been at the heart of the attack on Obamacare has been the so-called mandates, the requirements that people buy health insurance. So let's just look at the logic of mandates. How does this work? Why was a mandate built into this healthcare reform? Insurance companies make money by selling insurance to people who are healthy, right? So you make your money if you're an insurance company, and this doesn't have anything to do with being bad actors or being, you know, having bad motives. You make money if you're an insurance provider by selling insurance to people who don't get sick. Whenever they get sick, you have to pay out. If they don't get sick, you just get the premiums. So the fantasy of an insurance company is that people buy insurance because they are concerned about risk and then they don't get sick. If you're providing homeowners fire insurance, the optimal situation is that people really don't want their houses to burn down. They still buy the insurance because it could happen. And then everybody who's a homeowner takes a lot of care and no houses burn down. Well, if you're providing fire insurance, that's great. You get the premiums, you never have to pay for rebuilding a house. What does this mean in the healthcare? Insurance companies increase their profits by refusing to insure people with existing health problems because they know in advance that that person's going to have health costs, and by refusing to renew insurance once a person gets sick. That's just the sensible profit-maximizing thing to do. You want to make as much money as you can selling insurance in the healthcare market. You see somebody walk into your office and wants insurance and they have a healthcare problem, you say, sorry, we don't insure people like you. To guarantee universal access to insurance, these practices have to be prevented. If you want to live in a world where everybody can get health insurance, you have to prevent insurance companies from refusing to insure people. Insurance companies have to be prevented from refusing insurance because of pre-existing conditions. But this is only possible if healthy people are required to buy health insurance. Otherwise, they will wait until they get sick and then buy insurance. Right? So if you have a requirement that says insurance companies, you have to insure everybody. You cannot refuse insurance for a pre-existing condition, and you can't charge them extra premiums for a pre-existing condition. Right? You could, in effect, prevent somebody with a pre-existing condition from buying insurance if you said, okay, you can buy insurance, but your premiums are going to be $50,000 a year. So the rule is you can't deny for pre-existing conditions, and you can't take that into account in deciding the premium. Well, if you had no mandate, if people weren't required to buy insurance, as a consumer, what would be your rational thing to do? I'm healthy now. I'm going to wait until I get sick, and then I'm going to walk in the door and buy the insurance, and the insurance company can't refuse me because we have this new rule. Can't refuse somebody for pre-existing conditions. What would happen in the absence of a requirement that you buy insurance is that healthy people will simply not buy insurance. They'll wait until they get sick, and then they'll get the insurance. Just imagine that we had that for fire insurance, homeowners' fire insurance. We had a rule that said that insurance companies can't refuse insurance to somebody who wants homeowners' fire insurance regardless of the pre-existing fire status of the house. So what do? You wait till your house catches on fire, you quickly call an insurance agent and buy your insurance. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, no insurance company could possibly survive if you were allowed to buy fire insurance once your house was on fire. Well, in the healthcare case, that's kind of the logical equivalent. If you are going to force insurance companies to insure people with pre-existing conditions, then you have to force people who are healthy to buy insurance. This is another kind of free rider problem, right? In the absence of that mandate, what healthy people are doing is free riding on the contributions to insurance companies of everybody else. They want to get a free ride. They want to only pay for insurance when they're sick. Whereas that's not how you can have a cooperative insurance market. That's what the mandate solves. The mandate is simply a rule that says, if you're going to provide universal access with no pre-existing conditions, then you have to, and you're forcing insurance companies to follow that rule, then you have to force individuals to buy insurance. If you want to guarantee universal access and you want to maintain a private insurance market, you want those two things. Those were two constraints imposed on healthcare reform in the United States. We want universal access and we want a private insurance market. Then the only way you can do that, there is no other way to do it, is to require all people to buy insurance. I mean, there are actually some other ways you can do it, but they're less effective. This is called the mandate. I mean, here's just a simple arithmetic example. Suppose you have 20,000 people and 1,000 get sick a year and 19,000 don't. Okay, this is made up numbers. And suppose the medical expenses for those sick people are $20,000. Okay? The total medical costs then for in this imaginary world is $20 million a year. 1,000 get sick, 19,000 don't, $20 million a year. Now suppose insurance companies cannot refuse people because of prior conditions. They have to sell you a policy. And there is no mandate requiring people to buy health insurance. So there's no mandate. If you're healthy, you don't have to get insurance. And if you're sick, the insurance company has to insure you. What will be the insurance premium needed to cover the medical expenses? The insurance premiums that insurance companies require when you buy an insurance policy, that's their best guess as to how much they have to charge you for insurance in order to cover all the payouts they're going to have to do. Well, the answer in this made-up example is the insurance premiums will be $20,000 a year. That's what they'll have to charge the sick people who come in to buy health insurance, because if they charge anything less than that for the premium, they'll lose money. They won't be able to stay in business. If there's a mandate, they can charge only $1,000 a year. That is, premiums go down dramatically if there's a mandate, if people are required to buy insurance, because you're spreading the risks. You're spreading the risk. That's called the risk pool. You're spreading the risks. That's how all insurance works, and it's really the only way to make universal access with pre-existing conditions a possibility. Now, the other alternative, of course, is to just have direct government provision of insurance. You know, you can just have universal insurance where the premiums are effectively just paid out of taxation. You just provide insurance for everybody. That's another option. Most other countries provide universal health insurance simply by paying for it through taxes. There may be a specific piece of the taxes which are called health insurance taxes, but it's provided universally through the tax system. People don't have an opt-out option. They can buy supplementary private insurance if they want special treatment, if they want fancier rooms when they go to the hospital. Various other provisions that enable them to get elective surgeries more quickly, for example, if you have private insurance on top of your universal insurance. But that's another solution. That solves the mandate problem because everyone is forced to pay taxes. It's essentially the same as a mandate. It's like forcing healthy people to buy insurance if you force healthy people to pay taxes for universal insurance. Okay. That's point three about the American system. Point four, minimal concern with prevention. The American system as a whole is much more finely geared towards curing disease than preventing disease. Here's just some examples of weak preventative measures. Again, on many things, the United States is an outlier. We are the only country that doesn't provide universal free vaccinations for communicable diseases. You have to pay for vaccinations in the United States. We have no universal prenatal care. So prenatal care is extremely effective and efficient from a cost point of view. $1 spent on prenatal care leads to roughly $3 in savings in postnatal care. So while for any given person, the prenatal care may be just a nice add-on that doesn't prevent any future costs, for a population as a whole, prenatal care reduces postnatal expenses because you catch things early and you have early interventions and you see when there's something wrong in the diet or if there is a blood pressure or pregnancy-related diabetes problem that's occurring, whereas in the absence of prenatal care, those things go undetected and then cost more later on. Well, every place besides the U.S. has free prenatal care, knowing that this saves the system money. It's cheaper than charging people for prenatal care. If you charge people for prenatal care, if you have big deductibles and co-payments with prenatal care, then many people will not get enough of it. Weakness of occupational health and safety regulation enforcement. Occupational safety and health regulations, that's workplace regulations about toxins, about machinery, about ergonomic problems that affect the health of workers. These kinds of regulations should be thought of as preventative health care. If you have well-enforced occupational safety and health, you have fewer accidents and fewer workplace illnesses, which saves money on the treatment side. Well, the United States has pretty good occupational safety and health regulations on the books, but really lacks enforcement. And it's enforcement, of course, that matters. It doesn't matter what's written on paper on the books. What matters is whether you have inspectors who come around and check out things and see if there are hazards that should be remedied. This, of course, is experienced by businesses as red tape and regulations, and they object to it because it's costly. They would rather not be regulated and not be inspected. But from the point of view of the system as a whole, good occupational safety and health regulations and enforcement is more efficient. It saves money for the system as a whole. We also, in general, have no mandatory helmet laws for biking and motorcycles. And I thought this was a good moment for me to say to all of you, I know some of you ride bikes. I now am, when I'm driving, I normally don't drive much, but I'm having to drive because of my current condition. And driving home at night, I see people biking, wearing black, with no helmet. And I think, I want to stop that person and shake them. I did have a helmet. I still had a concussion when I was hit by a car last November. I had a helmet. I probably would not be here talking to you today if I didn't have a helmet. So any of you who ride a bike or a motorcycle, even worse, get a helmet. Come on. I assume for most of you, your brains are one of your favorite organs. Don't put it at risk. I mean, it's just crazy. And don't wear black at night riding a bicycle and expect a tired driver who is paying attention to whatever to necessarily see you. I was hit in the broad daylight, beautiful sunny day, with no traffic. There was obviously a little traffic, but be sensible about that. All right, of course, I'm invoking here individual responsibility, right? Take responsibility for your own preventative medicine. Wear a helmet. A mandatory helmet law takes that responsibility away from a person and says, we're going to force you to wear a helmet. Now, why should we accept in a liberal society being forced to wear a helmet? Well, I think the argument here is not just paternalism. It's not just this is a way of getting particularly teenagers and young people who think they'll live forever to behave rationally, to realize that they are taking risks that they may not even realize. That's paternalism. That's saying people aren't responsible enough and we'll take it over. But there's another reason, which is that if you get a serious brain injury, you impose huge costs on other people. That is, you're taking the risks, but you're displacing the costs of those risks on others. Because we simply don't let people who can be saved die in the streets. And if they need lifelong care, then you're eligible for the Medicare, the part of Medicare or Medicaid that applies to, or Social Security that applies to people with permanent disabilities. You are a cost to the society as a whole if you have an accident and you're not wearing a helmet. And that's justification for forcing people to wear helmets. The alternative would be for people who refuse to wear a helmet to sign a waiver which says, if I have an accident and am disabled, let me die. Don't provide any aid. I don't get Social Security. Well, we're not that kind. Even this, a society that's as individualistic and market-driven as we are not that kind of society. We don't want to allow people to opt out of our collective caring for people with disabilities, even if it was a result of irresponsibility when they had an accident. That's the justification for mandatory helmets. Mandatory helmets are preventative medicine. To be thought of as preventative medicine. That's what it does. It prevents the need for treatment. Finally, on top of all this, we're not just the most expensive in the world with lower access. We actually have worse health results than other countries. I mean, that's the kicker. We're spending all this money. We have this complicated market-driven system. We don't concern ourselves with prevention. And on top of it all, we have the worst health results, worse health results than other rich countries. Some of this data is in the book, but I'll just give you a few bits of it. Infant deaths per 1,000 live births. We rank 36th in the world. For African Americans, the United States ranks 70th, if we consider that a separate statistic. Life expectancy at birth. Canada ranks 10th. That's a country rather like us. The United States ranks 32nd in the world. The ratio of African American infant mortality rates to white infant mortality rates from 1964 to the present. The part of that curve in which there's an improvement and the ratio of infant mortality rates for African Americans and whites begins to become more equal. That's the period where the war on poverty is actually doing something about poverty in the United States, starting in the 1980s especially, but beginning in the 70s, the war on poverty runs out of steam, and then inequality increases in the economy and the society as a whole, as we will discuss in the next part of the course. And along with that comes an increasing disproportion in the infant mortality rates of whites and black children. Here's the relationship between health spending and life expectancy at birth. As you can see, the United States is an outlier. We spend more than any other country per capita. This is old data, 1990 data, but it'll be the same basic configuration today as well. There are two kinds of arguments in defense of private market-based health insurance system. The first is that competition spurs cost savings and innovation. That's certainly true in lots of sectors of the economy. You get more competition, you get innovation. And you get cost savings because competitors are competing on price. And secondly, free markets solve the moral hazard problem. Let me explain the moral hazard problem. this is another one of these interesting ideas that comes from a certain branch of economics, and which applies to lots of situations, but has become a particularly salient part of the discussion over health insurance. A moral hazard is a situation in which there's no incentive to worry about costs since someone else is paying the bill. Insurance sometimes creates a moral hazard by enabling people to engage in riskier behavior than they otherwise would. So if you're insured, you're prepared to engage in riskier behavior than if you're uninsured. Why? Because you know, your insurance will cover the costs if the risks turn out badly. The moral hazard in healthcare is that if you have insurance, you will tend to overuse medical services, since you don't have to pay each time you go to the doctor. This has the effect of imposing costs on others. It raises everybody's insurance premiums if you overuse the healthcare system by virtue of being insured. That's the moral hazard problem, and the solution that is argued for is that we should rely on market and competition to force down prices and enforce personal responsibility through co-pays, deductibles, paperwork, and administrative controls. Do all these things to make it costlier for people to use the healthcare system, and then you will undercut this moral hazard problem. You'll hesitate. Should I go to the doctor? Should I not go to the doctor? Well, I'm feeling crappy. Should I do it? Should I not? No, I'll wait, because I don't want to pay the co-pays and deal with the paperwork connected with going to the doctor. So it forces people to take responsibility for their own choices. That's the argument. Well, so these are the two arguments: competition spurs cost savings, free markets solve the moral hazard problem. Let me just assess these arguments, the counter arguments to those defenses of a market-based system for healthcare. First, the competition argument. That should be a hyphen between for and profit. For-profit hospitals turn out not to be more efficient than non-profit hospitals. It just isn't the case that they're more efficient. They're just more selective. For-profit hospitals are more selective in that they turn more people away and send them to public hospitals or not-for-profit hospitals. The competition argument would suggest that if you're a profit-maximizing hospital, you should be a more efficient producer of medical services because you're trying to maximize your profits. So you'll try to minimize your costs. But that's not how it works. They do make more profits, but they do so by turning away people. And furthermore, increased competition can lead to increased costs. Supply creates demand, the point that I made earlier as a peculiar feature of the healthcare sector. On the moral hazard problem, this is a real problem. You know, it's not that it's a made-up issue, but it's not as big a problem as certain other problems. And in fact, other problems may cut against the moral hazard problem. So, for example, it's a much more serious problem for the overall cost of the healthcare system that people wait too long to go to the doctor rather than they overuse the healthcare system. Delay of treatment causes more expense than does overuse. You know, we have little aphorisms for this. A stitch in time saves nine. A visit to the doctor when you begin to feel sick saves on huge costs later if the diagnosis early on can prevent more serious complications. That cuts against the moral hazard problem. So even if there is a moral hazard problem, you'll use the doctors more because you're insured than if you were uninsured. That's certainly true. If you're uninsured, you're way less likely to go to the doctor than if you're insured. It's not the case that people have this great desire to use the healthcare system as much as possible. You know, there are people who have particular psychiatric disorders in which going to the doctor satisfies certain needs for attention. That's, of course, a small part of the healthcare problem. So that's the first point. Waiting too long is a way bigger problem than overusing the healthcare system. And if we encouraged people to go to the doctor as soon as they felt sick, we would have more early doctor visits, but we'd have lower total costs in the healthcare system. It's an irony about the way healthcare works. And secondly, as long as there is insurance, there will be some kind of moral hazard problem. I mean, of course, that's That's intrinsic to insurance. But it doesn't mean that the solutions to the moral hazard problem are worth the costs, because the solutions themselves have costs. The effort to deal with the problem costs more than the problem itself. What is described as the overhead costs of health insurance in the United States, the administrative costs of having so many forms to fill out and so many conflicting rules about particular kinds of insurance, that creates a huge overhead overhang on the American healthcare system, much of which is bound up with this effort to deal with the moral hazard problem. It is a problem, but it's not a big problem compared to the costs involved in trying to solve the problem. Okay, let me give you two empirical comparisons. Now, these are discussed in detail in the book. We won't have time to go through this in the remaining 5 minutes, so I'll just gesture at it here, make a few comments. These are two comparisons of ways of providing health care that rely less heavily on the market and which provide better outcomes than the market-based system. The first is the U.S. Veterans Administration hospital system before the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. So this is back in the early 2000s, before this system was overwhelmed by the additional burden of dealing with wounded veterans. And the second is the Canadian single-payer system. So first, let's look at the Veterans Administration. This is the administrative overhead costs as a percentage of total costs in the provision of different forms of health insurance, comparing Canada and the various ways that health insurance is provided in the United States. In the American system, private insurance, for private insurers, pushing towards 12% of their total costs were administrative costs. That is, simply to administer the private health insurance system costs about 12% of the total revenues of the private health insurance system. Whereas for the Veterans Administration, it's just a bit over 2%. It was extremely efficient administratively. Again, before the Iraq and Afghan wars. The reasons for the high quality and low cost in the Veterans Health Administration are as follows. There was a study done by the New England Journal of Medicine, and I think it was published in 2005. The data comes from a few years earlier, which in the end did rank the Veterans Administration hospitals as the best in the US. Why was it so successful? It had economies of scale. It could purchase things in huge volumes and therefore reduce costs. It was allowed to negotiate discounts with drug companies. It had incentives for investing in quality, and especially incentives for preventative medicine. The VA itself had incentives for prevention because it knew that the patients it was dealing with, it would deal with throughout their whole lives. It had very long time horizons in which they could ask, is it worth engaging in this preventative activity? Yes, it is, because we're going to see this patient for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And it had extremely efficient medical record and information systems and health monitoring because of this lifetime connection. They could track the same people over time and keep track of them. But, and here's the kind of Achilles heel of the VA and other similar government-provided services, they are vulnerable to underfunding. Underfunding and understaffing is a problem because when, particularly for a Veterans Administration facility, when the demand for their services escalates, they need more appropriation in order to provide the service because they don't charge anything. They can't deal with a higher demand by raising their prices. They deal with a higher demand by requesting from Congress greater funding. And one of the great ironies of the last 15 years is that although the United States engaged in a very prolonged, still ongoing military expeditions abroad, and because our battlefield medicine has improved so much, the rate of long-term medical problems and disability problems for veterans is greater now than in previous wars. Many of the soldiers who returned disabled would have died in previous wars because battlefield medicine has improved so much. Congress authorized the funding for the military expeditions, but did not authorize commensurate increase in funding for the Veterans Administration. And what's happening is that my generation, you know, the 60s generation, is now aging into the point in their lives where they have greater health care needs. And the Veterans Administration, like all healthcare, the entire healthcare system, is dealing with aging baby boomers from the Vietnam War era. So suddenly there's increased demands, not suddenly for the Vietnam era veterans, suddenly there's huge increased demand for Veterans Administration services from the current wars. And then there's this slowly escalating demand for healthcare services from the now aging Vietnam War veterans. And the VA system has deteriorated significantly in the past decade, signaled by the long wait times for certain kinds of services, because the funding levels have not kept up with this increased demand on its services. Well, I won't describe the Canadian system. You should read it carefully. In the book, and I will see you on Thursday to discuss finance.